Amen. He lowered his head briefly. His wallet stuck out of his back pocket. It was on a chain. Of course it was. Men like Jim Dooley always wore their wallets on chains that were attached to their belt loops. Now he looked up again and said,
He deserved a nice place like this. I hope he enjoyed it, when he wasn't agonizing over his creations.
Lisi thought of Scott at the desk he called Dumbo's Big Jumbo, sitting before his big screen Mac and laughing at something he'd just written, chewing either a plastic straw or his own fingernails, sometimes singing along with the music, making arm farts if it was summer and hot and his shirt was off. That was how he agonized over his smucking creations. But she still said nothing. On the sound system, old Hank gave way to his son. Junior was singing, Whiskey Bent and Hellbound. Dooley said,
Giving me the old silent treatment? Well, more power to you, but it won't do you no good, missus. You have some correction coming. I won't try to sell you the old one about how it's gonna hurt me more than it's gonna hurt you. But I will say I've come to like your spunk in the short time I've known you, and that it's going to hurt both of us. I also want to say I'll go as easy as I can, 'cause I don't want to break that spirit of yours. Still, we had an agreement, and you didn't keep to it.
An agreement? Lisi felt a chill sweep through her body. For the first time, she got a clear picture of the breadth and complexity of Dooley's insanity. The gray wings threatened to descend across her vision, and this time, she fought them fiercely. Dooley heard the rattle of the handcuff chain. He must have had the cuffs in his sack along with the mayonnaise jar, and turned to her.
Easy, baby love, easy, Scott murmured. Talk to the guy. Run your everlasting mouth.
This was advice Lisi hardly needed. As long as the talking was going on, the correctin' would remain deferred.
Listen to me, Mr. Dooley. We didn't have an agreement. You're mistaken about that.
She saw his brow begin to furrow, his look begin to darken, and hurried on.
Sometimes it's hard to get things together over the phone, but I'm ready to work with you now.
She swallowed and heard a distinct click in her throat. She was ready for more water, a good long cool drink of it, but this didn't seem like a good time to ask. She leaned forward, fixed his eyes with her own, blue on blue, and spoke with all the earnestness and sincerity she could muster.
I'm saying that as far as I'm concerned, you've made your point. And you know what? You were just looking at the manuscripts your colleague especially wants. Did you notice the black file cabinets in the central space?
Now he was looking at her with his eyebrows hoisted and a skeptical little smile playing on his mouth. But that might only be his dickering look. Lisi allowed herself to hope.
Looked to me like there was a right smart of boxes downstairs, too, he said. More of his books, from the look of them.
Those are... What was she going to tell him? Those are bools, not books? She guessed that most of them were, but Dooley wouldn't understand.
They're practical jokes. Scott's version of itchy powder and plastic vomit?
That he'd understand, but likely not believe. He was still looking at her with that skeptical smile, not a dickering look at all. No, this was a look that said, While you're at it, why don't you go on and pull the other one, missus?
There's nothing in those cartons downstairs but carbon copies and Xeroxes and blank sheets, she said, and it sounded like a lie because it was a lie. And what was she supposed to say? You're too crazy to understand the truth, Mr. Dooley.
Instead, she rushed on.
The stuff Wood Smucky wants, the good stuff, is all up here. Unpublished stories, copies of letters to other writers, their letters back to him.
Dooley threw back his head and laughed.
Wood Smucky, missus, you got your husband's way with words.
Then the laughter faded, and although the smile stayed on his lips, there was no more amusement in his eyes. His eyes looked like ice.
So what do you think I should do? Hie over to Oxford or Mechanic Falls and rent a U-Haul, then come back here, load those filing cabinets up? Say, Maybe you could get one of those deputy boys to help me.
I... Shut up. Pointing a finger at her, the smile all gone now.
Why, if I was to go away and then come back, you'd have a dozen state police graybacks here waiting for me, I reckon. They'd take me in. And, missus, I tell you what, I'd deserve another 10 years inside just for believing such a thing.
But, and besides, that
wasn't the deal we made. The deal was that you'd call the prof, old Woodsmucky. Girl, I like that. And he'd send me an email the special way we have. And then he'd arrange about the papers, right?
Part of him actually believed this. Had to believe it, or why would he keep on with it when it was just the two of them?
Ma'am?
Dooley asked her. He sounded solicitous.
Mrs.?
If there was a part of him that had to go on telling lies when it was just the two of them, maybe it was because there was a part of him that needed lying too. If so, that was the part of Jim Dooley she needed to reach. The part that might still be sane. Mr. Dooley, listen to me. She pitched her voice low and kept her delivery slow. It had been the way she talked to Scott when Scott was ready to go off half-cocked over anything from a bad review to a shoddy piece of plumbing. Professor Woodbody has no way of getting in touch with you, and down inside somewhere you know that. But I can get in touch with him. I already have. I called him last night.
You're lying,
he said. But this time she wasn't, and he knew she wasn't. And for some reason, it upset him. That reaction ran exactly counter to the one she wanted to provoke. She wanted to soothe him, but she thought she had to go on, hoping the sane part of Jim Dooley was in there somewhere, listening. I'm not, she said. You left me his number, and I called him. Holding Dooley's eyes with hers, mustering every bit of sincerity she could manage as she headed back into the land of fabrication. I promised him the manuscripts and told him to call you off, and he said he couldn't call you off because he had no way of getting in touch with you anymore. He said his first two emails went through, but after that, they just bounced back.
One lies and the other swears to it,
Jim Dooley said, and after that, things happened with a speed and a ferocity Lisi could hardly credit, although every moment of the beating and mutilation that followed remained vivid in her mind for the rest of her life, right down to the sound of his dry and rapid breathing, right down to the way his khaki shirt strained at the buttons, showing little winks of the white t-shirt he wore beneath as he slapped her across her face, backhand and then forehand again. 8 blows in all. 8, 8, lay them straight, they chanted as children skip-roping in the dooryard dust, and the sound of his skin on her skin was like dry kindling snapped over a knee, and although the hand he used was ringless, there was that much to be grateful for. The 4th and 5th blows beat the blood from her lips, the 6th and 7th sent it spraying, and the last rode high enough to smash her nose and set that gushing as well. By then she was crying in fear and pain. Her head thumped repeatedly against the underside of the bar sink, making her ears ring. She heard herself crying out for him to stop, that he could have whatever he wanted if he would only stop. Then he did stop, and she heard herself saying, I can give you the manuscript of a new novel, his last novel. It's all done. He finished it a month before he died and never got a chance to revise it. It's a real treasure. Woodsmucky'll love it. She had time to think, that's pretty inventive. What are you going to do if he takes you up on it? But Jim Dooley wasn't taking her up on anything. He was on his knees in front of her, panting harshly. It was hot up here already. If she'd known she was going to be taking a beating in Scott's study today, she certainly would have turned on the air conditioning first thing, and rummaging in his lunch sack again. There were big sweat rings spreading out from under his arms.
Mrs., I'm sorry as hell to do this, but at least it ain't your pussy, he said.
And she had time to register two things before he swept his left hand down the front of her, tearing open her blouse and popping the catch at the front of her bra so that her small breasts tumbled free. The first was that he wasn't sorry a bit. The second was that the object in his right hand had almost certainly come from her very own things drawer. Scott had called it Lisi's yuppie church key. It was her OXO can opener, the one with the heavy-duty rubber hand grips. Chapter 10. Lisi and the Arguments Against Insanity. The Good Brother. 1. The arguments against insanity fall through with a soft shirring sound. This line kept going through Lisi's head as she crawled from the memory nook and then slowly across the center space of her dead husband's long and rambling office, leaving an ugly trail behind her. Splotches of blood from her nose, mouth, and mutilated breast. The blood will never come out of this carpet, she thought, and the line recurred, as if in an answer. The arguments against insanity fall through with a soft shirring sound. There was insanity in this story, all right, but the only sound she remembered just lately wasn't whirring, purring, or shirring. It was the sound of her screams when Jim Dooley had attached her can opener to her left breast like a mechanical leech. She had screamed, and then she had fainted, and then he had slapped her awake to tell her one more thing. After that, he'd let her go back under again, but he had pinned a note to her shirt. After considerately pulling off her ruined bra and buttoning the shirt back up, that was. To make sure she wouldn't forget. She hadn't needed the note. She remembered what he'd said perfectly. I'd better hear from the prof by 8 tonight, or next time the hurtin' will be a lot worse. And tend yourself by yourself, missus, you hear me now? Tell anyone I was here, and I'll kill you. That was what Dooley had said. To this, the note pinned on her shirt had added, Let's get this business finished. We will both be happier when it is. Signed, Your Good Friend, Zach. Lisi had no idea how long she was out the second time. All she knew was that when she came to, the mangled bra was in the wastebasket, and the note was pinned to the right side of her shirt. The left side was soaked with blood. She had unbuttoned enough to take one quick peek, then moaned and averted her eyes. It looked worse than anything Amanda had ever done to herself, including the thing with the navel. As to the pain, all she could remember was something enormous and obliterating. The handcuffs had been removed, and Dooley had even left her a glass of water. Lisi drank it greedily. When she tried to get to her feet, however, her legs were trembling too badly to hold her. So she had crawled out of the alcove on all fours, dripping blood and bloody sweat on Scott's carpet as she went. Ah, but she'd never cared for that oyster white anyway. It showed every speck of dirt. Hair plastered to her forehead, tears drying on her cheeks, blood drying to a crust on her nose, lips, and chin. At first she thought she was headed for the phone, probably to call Deputy Buttercluck, in spite of Dooley's admonitions, and the failure of the Castle County Sheriff's Department to protect her on its first try. Then that line of poetry, The Arguments Against Insanity, started to go through her head, and she saw Goodma's cedar box lying overturned on the carpet between the stairs going down to the barn, and the desk Scott had called Dumbo's Big Jumbo. The cedar box's contents were spilled on the carpet in an untidy litter. She understood that the box and its spilled contents had been her destination all along. She especially wanted the yellow thing she could see draped over the bent purple shape of the Antlers menu. The arguments against insanity fall through with a soft, shirring sound. From one of Scott's poems. He didn't write many, and those he did he almost never published. He said they weren't good, and he wrote them just for himself. But she had thought that one very good, even though she hadn't been entirely sure what it meant, or even what it was about. She had particularly liked that first line, because sometimes you just heard things going, didn't you? They fell down, level after level, leaving a hole you could look through, or fall into if you weren't careful. So wheeze a baby love. You're bound for the rabbit hole, so strap on nice and tight. Dooley must have brought Goodma's box up to the study because he thought it had to do with what he wanted. Guys like Dooley and Gerd Allen Cole, a.k.a. Blondie, a.k.a. Monsieur Ding Dong for the Freezers, thought everything had to do with what they wanted, didn't they? Their nightmares, their phobias, their midnight inspirations. What had Dooley thought was in the cedar box? A secret list of Scott's manuscripts, perhaps in code? God knew. In any case, he dumped it out, seen nothing but a jumble of uninteresting rickrack, uninteresting to him at least, and then dragged the Widow Landon deeper into the study, looking for a place where he could cuff her up before she regained consciousness. The pipes under the bar sink had done quite nicely. Lisi crawled steadily toward the scattered contents of the box, her eyes fixed on the yellow knitted square. She wondered if she would have discovered it on her own. She had an idea the answer was no. She had gotten her fill of memories. Now, however, the arguments against insanity fall through with a soft, shirring sound. So it seemed. And if her precious purple curtain finally came down, would it make that same soft, sad sound? She wouldn't be at all surprised. It had never been much more than spun cobwebs to begin with. Look at all she'd already remembered.
No more, Lisi. You don't dare. Hush.
Hush yourself, she croaked.
Her outraged breast throbbed and burned. Scott had gotten his chest wound. Now she had hers. She thought of him coming back up her lawn that night, coming out of the shadows while Pluto barked and barked and barked next door. Scott holding up what had been a hand and was now nothing but a clot of blood with things that looked vaguely like fingers sticking out of it. Scott telling her it was a blood bowl, and it was for her. Scott later soaking that sliced-up meat in a basin filled with weak tea, telling her how it was something, Paul thought this up, his brother had shown him how to do, telling her all the Landons were fast healers, they had to be. This memory fell through to the one beneath, the one where she and Scott were sitting under the yum-yum tree 4 months later. The blood fell down in a sheet, Scott told her, and Lisi asked if Paul soaked his cuts in tea afterward, and Scott had said no. Hush, Lisi, he never said that. You never asked, and he never said. But she had asked. She had asked him all sorts of things, and Scott had answered. Not then, not under the yum-yum tree, but later on. That night in bed. Their second night in the antlers, after making love. How could she have forgotten? Lisi lay for a moment on the oyster-white carpet, resting. Never forgot, she said. It was in the purple, behind the curtain. Big difference. She fixed her eyes on the yellow square and began crawling again.
I'm pretty sure the tea cure came later, Lisi. Yeah, I know it did.
Scott lying next to her, smoking, watching the smoke from his cigarette go up and up, to that place where it disappeared. The way the stripes on a barber pole disappear. The way Scott himself sometimes disappeared.
I know, because by then I was doing fractions.
In school?
No, Lisi.
He said this in a tone that said more, that said she should know better. Sparky Landon had never been that kind of daddy.
Me and Paul, we was homeschooled. Daddy called public school the donkey corral.
But Paul's cuts that day, the day you jumped from the bench, were they bad? Not just nicks? A long pause while he watched the smoke rise and stack and disappear, leaving only its trail of sweetish, bitter fragrance behind. At last, flat. Daddy cut deep. To that dry certainty there seemed no possible reply, so she had kept silent. And then he'd said,
Anyway, that's not what you want to ask.
Ask what you want, Lisi. Go ahead, I'll tell you. But you have to ask. She either couldn't remember what had come next or wasn't ready to, but now she remembered how they had left their refuge under the yum-yum tree. He had taken her in his arms beneath that white umbrella, and they had been outside in the snow an instant later. And now crawling on her hands and knees toward the overturned cedar box, memory, insanity, fell through with a soft, shirring sound, and Lisi finally allowed her mind to believe what her second heart, her secret hidden heart, had known all along. For a moment they had been neither under the yum-yum tree nor out in the snow, but in another place. It had been warm and filled with hazy red light. It had been filled with the sound of distant calling birds and tropical smells. Some of these she knew, frangipani Jasmine, bougainvillea, mimosa, the moist breathing earth upon which they knelt like the lovers they most surely were. But the sweetest ones were unknown to her, and she ached for their names. She remembered opening her mouth to speak, and Scott putting the side of his hand, hush, to her mouth. She remembered thinking how strange it was that they should be dressed for winter in such a tropical place, and she saw he was afraid. Then they had been outside in the snow, that crazy downpouring October snow. How long had they been in the in-between place? 3 seconds? Maybe even less. But now, crawling because she was too weak and too shocked to stand, Lisi was at last willing to own up to the truth of it. By the time they made it back to the antlers that day, she'd gotten a fair distance towards convincing herself it hadn't happened. But it had. Happened again, too, she said. Happened that night. She was so smucking thirsty. Wanted another drink of water in the worst way. But of course the bar alcove was behind her. She was going the wrong way for water, and she could remember Scott singing one of old Hank's songs as they drove back that Sunday, singing, "All day I've faced the barren waste, without a single taste of water, cool water." "You'll get your drink, baby love." "Will I?" Still nothing but a crow croak. "A drink of water would surely help. This hurts so bad." To this there was no reply, and perhaps she didn't need one. She had finally reached the scatter of objects around the overturned cedar box. She reached out for the yellow square, plucked it off the purple menu, and closed it tight in her hand. She lay on her side, the one that didn't hurt, and looked at it closely. The little lines of knits and pearls, those tiny locks. There was blood on her fingers and it smeared on the wool, but she hardly noticed. Good Ma had knitted dozens of afghans out of squares like this. Afghans of rose and gray, afghans of blue and gold, afghans of green and burnt orange. They were Good Ma's specialty, and spilled from her needles, one after the other, as she sat in front of the chattering TV at night. Lisi remembered how, as a child, she had thought such knitted blankets were called Africans. Their female cousins, Angletons, Darbys, Wigginses, and Washburns, as well as Debushers, almost beyond counting, had all been gifted with Africans when they were married. Each one of the Debusher girls had gotten at least 3, and with each African came one extra square in the same shade or pattern. Good Ma called these extra squares delights. They were meant as table decorations, or to be framed and hung on the wall. Because the yellow African had been Good Ma's wedding present to Lisi and Scott, and because Scott had always loved it, Lisi had saved the accompanying delight in the cedar box. Now she lay bleeding on his carpet, holding the square, and gave up trying to forget. She thought, "Fool, the end," and began to cry. She understood she was incapable of coherence, but maybe that was all right. Order would come later if it was needed. And, of course, if there was a later. The Gomers and the Bad Gunky. For the Landons and the Landros before them, it's always been one or the other, and it always comes out. It was really no surprise Scott had recognized Amanda for what she was. He'd known about cutting behavior firsthand. How many times had he cut himself? She didn't know. You couldn't read his scars the way you could read Amanda's because... well, because... The one incidence of self-mutilation she knew about for sure, the night of the greenhouse, had been spectacular, however. And he had learned about cutting from his father, who only turned his knife on his boys when his own body would not suffice to let the Bad Gunky out. Gomers and Bad Gunky, always one or the other, it always comes out. And if Scott had missed the worst of the Bad Gunky, what did that leave? In December of 1995, the weather had turned rottenly cold, and something started going wrong with Scott. He had a number of speaking gigs planned after the turn of the year at schools in Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Arizona, what he referred to as the Scott Landon 1996 Western Yahoo Tour, but called his literary agent and had him cancel the whole deal. The booking agency screamed blue murder. No surprise there. That was $300,000 worth of speaking dates he was talking about flushing down the commode. But Scott held firm. He said the tour was impossible, said he was sick. He was sick, all right. As that winter sank its claws in deeper, Scott Landon had been a sick man indeed. Lisi knew as early as November that something... Two. She knows something's wrong with him, and it isn't bronchitis as he's been claiming. He has no cough, and his skin's cool to the touch, so even though he won't let her take his temperature, won't even let her put one of those fever strip thingies on his forehead, she's pretty sure he's not running a fever. The problem seems to be mental rather than physical, and that scares the hell out of her. The one time she gets up enough courage to suggest he go see Dr. Bjorn, he just about tears her head off. Accuses her of being a doctor junkie, like the rest of your nutbox sisters. And how is she supposed to respond to that? What exactly are the symptoms he's displaying? Would any doctor, even a sympathetic one like Rick Bjorn, take them seriously? He stopped listening to music when he writes, that's one thing. And he's not writing much, that's another much bigger thing. Forward progress on his new novel, which Lisi Landon, admittedly no great book critic, happens to love, has slowed from his usual all-out sprint to a labored crawl. Bigger still. Dear Christ, where's his sense of humor? That boisterous sense of good humor can be wearing, but its sudden absence as fall gives way to cold weather is downright spooky. It's like the moment in one of those old jungle movies where the native drums suddenly fall silent. He's drinking more, too, and later into the night. She has always gone to bed earlier than he does, usually much earlier, but she almost always knows when he turns in and what she smells on his breath when he does. She also knows what she sees in his trash cans up in his study, and as her worries grow, she makes a special point to look every 2 or 3 days. She's used to seeing beer cans, sometimes a great lot of them. Scott has always liked his beer. But in December of 1995 and early January of 1996, she also begins to see Jim Beam bottles, and Scott is suffering hangovers. For some reason, this bothers her more than all the rest. Sometimes he wanders the house, pale, silent, ill, until the middle of the afternoon before finally perking up. On several occasions, she has heard him vomiting behind the closed bathroom door, and she knows by the speed with which the aspirin is disappearing that he's suffering bad headaches. Nothing unusual in that, you might say. Drink a case of beer or a bottle of Beam between 9 and midnight, you're going to pay the price, Patrick. And maybe that's all it is, but Scott has been a heavy drinker since the night she met him in that university lounge, when he had a bottle squirreled away in his jacket pocket. He shared it with her. And he's never suffered more than the mildest of hangovers. Now, when she sees the empties in his wastebasket, and that only a page or two has been added to the Outlaw's honeymoon manuscript on his big desk, some days there are no new pages at all. She wonders just how much more he's drinking than what she knows about. For a little while, she's able to forget her worries in the round of year-end holiday visiting and the jostle of Christmas shopping. Scott has never been much of a shopper, even when things are slow and the stores are empty. But this season, he throws himself into it with hectic good cheer. He's out with her every smucking day, doing battle at either the Auburn Mall or the Main Street shops in Castle Rock. He's recognized often, but cheerfully refuses the frequent autograph requests from people who smell the chance for a one-of-a-kind gift, telling them that if he doesn't stick with his wife, he probably won't see her again until Easter. He may have lost his sense of humor, but she never sees him lose his temper, not even when some of the folks who want autographs get pushy. And so for a while there, he seems sort of all right, sort of himself in spite of the drinking, the canceled tour, and his slow progress on the new book. Christmas itself is a happy day, with lots of presents exchanged and an energetic midday tumble in the sack. Christmas dinner is at Canty and Rich's, and over dessert, Rich asks Scott when he's going to produce one of the movies made from his novels. "That's where the big money is," Rich says, seemingly ignorant of the fact that of the 4 film adaptations so far, 3 have bombed. Only the movie version of Empty Devils, which Lisi has never seen, made money. On the way home, Scott's sense of humor swoops back in like a big old B-1 bomber, and he does a killer imitation of Rich that has Lisi laughing until her belly cramps up. And when they arrive back at Sugartop Hill, they proceed upstairs for a second tumble in the sack. In the afterglow, Lisi finds herself thinking that if Scott is sick, maybe more people should catch what he has, the world would be a better place. She wakes around 2 a.m. on Boxing Day, needing to use the bathroom, and... talk about deja vu all over again. He's not in bed. but this time not gone. She has come to know the difference without even letting herself know what she means when she thinks, gone, about that thing he sometimes does, that place he sometimes goes. She urinates with her eyes shut, listening to the wind outside the house. It sounds cold, that wind, but she doesn't know what cold is, not yet. Let another couple of weeks pass, and she will. Let another couple of weeks pass, and she'll know all sorts of things. When she's done with the toilet, she peeks out the bathroom window. This looks toward the barn and Scott's study in the converted hayloft. If he was up there, and when he gets restless in the middle of the night, that is where he usually goes, she'd see the lights, perhaps even hear the happy carnival sounds of his rock and roll music very faint. Tonight the barn is dark, and the only music she hears is the pitch pipe of the wind. This makes her a little uneasy, hatches thoughts in the back of her brain, heart attack, stroke, that are too unpleasant to completely consider, yet a little too strong given how off he's been lately, to completely dismiss. So instead of sleepwalking back to the bedroom, she goes to the bathroom's other door, the one that gives on the upstairs hall. She calls his name and gets no answer, but she sees a slim gold bar of light shining beneath the closed door at the far end. And now, very faint, she hears the sound of music coming from down there. Not rock and roll, but country. It's Hank Williams. Old Hank is singing Kalijah. Scott? She calls again. And when there's no answer, she goes down there, brushing the hair out of her eyes, bare feet whispering on a carpet that will later wind up in the attic, frightened for no reason she can articulate, except it has something to do with gone, things that are either finished or should be. All done and buttoned up, Dad DeBuscher might have said. That was one old dandy caught from the pool, the one where we all go down to drink, the one where we cast our nets. Scott? She stands before the guest room door for a moment, and a horrible premonition comes to her. He's sitting dead in the rocking chair in front of the television, dead by his own hand. Why had she not seen this coming? Haven't all the symptoms been on display for a month or more? He has held out until Christmas, held out for her sake, but now... Scott? She turns the knob and pushes the door open, and he's in the rocking chair just as she had imagined him, but very much alive, swaddled in his favorite Good Ma African, the yellow one. On the television, the sound turned low, is his favorite movie, The Last Picture Show. His eyes don't move from it to her. Scott, are you okay? His eyes don't move, don't blink. She begins to be very afraid then, and in the back of her mind, one of Scott's strange words, Gomer, pops off a haunted assembly line, and she swats it back into her subconscious with a barely articulated smucket curse. She steps into the room and speaks his name again. This time he does blink, thank God, and turns his head to look at her and smiles. It's the Scott Landon smile she fell in love with the first time she saw it. Mostly the way it makes his eyes turn up at the corners. Hey, Lisey, he says. What are you doing up? I could ask you the same question, she says. She looks for booze, a can of beer, maybe a half-finished bottle of Beam, and doesn't see any. That's good. It's late, don't you know, late. There is a long pause during which he seems to think this over very carefully. Then he says, the wind woke me. It was rattling one of the gutters against the side of the house and I couldn't go back to sleep. She starts to speak, but doesn't. When you've been married a long time, she supposes how long varies from marriage to marriage. With them it took about 15 years. A kind of telepathy sets in. Right now it's telling her he has something more to say. So she stays quiet, waiting to see if she's right. At first, it seems she is. He opens his mouth. Then the wind gusts outside and she hears it, a low quick rattling like the chatter of metal teeth. He cocks his head toward it, smiles a little. Not a nice smile. The smile of someone who has a secret. And closes his mouth again. Instead of saying whatever it was he meant to say, he looks back at the TV screen, where Jeff Bridges, a very young Jeff Bridges, and his best friend are now driving to Mexico. When they get back, Sam the Lion will be dead. Do you think you could go to sleep now? she asks him, and when he doesn't respond, she begins to feel afraid again. "Scott," she says a little more sharply than she intended, and when he returns his eyes to her, reluctantly, Lisi fancies, although he has seen this movie at least 24 times, she repeats her question more quietly. "Do you think you could go back to sleep now?" "Maybe," he allows, and she sees something that is both terrible and sad. He is afraid. "If you sleep spoons with me."
"As cold as it is tonight, are you kidding?
Come on, turn off the TV and come back to bed." He does, and she lies there listening to the wind and luxuriating in the man-driven warmth of him. She begins to see her butterflies. This is what almost always happens to her when she begins to drift into sleep. She sees great red and black butterflies opening their wings in the dark. It has occurred to her that she will see them when her dying time comes around. The thought scares her, but only a little. "Lisi?" It's Scott from far away. He's drifting too, she senses that.
"Hmm?
It doesn't like me to talk."
"What doesn't?"
"I don't know."
Very faint and far.
"Maybe it's the wind, the cold wind, the one that comes down from..."
The last word might be Canada, probably is, but there's no way to tell for sure because by then she's lost in the land of sleep and he is too. And when they go there, they never go together, and she is afraid that there is also a preview of death, a place where there may be dreams but never love, never home. Never a hand to hold yours when squadrons of birds flock across the burnt orange sun at the close of the day.
3. There's a period of time, 2 weeks maybe, when she goes on trying to believe that things are getting better. Later she'll ask herself how she could be so stupid, so willfully blind, how she could mistake his frantic struggle to hold on to the world and her for any kind of improvement. But of course, when straws are all you have, you grasp them. There are some fat ones to grasp at. During the opening days of 1996, his drinking seems to stop entirely, except for a glass of wine with dinner on a couple of occasions, and he trundles out to his study every day. "It will only be later, 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 percolator," they used to chant when they were little kids building their first word castles in the sand at the edge of the pool. That she'll realize he hasn't added a single page to the manuscript of the novel during those days, has done nothing but drink secret whiskey and eat certs and write disjointed notes to himself. Tucked beneath the keyboard of the Mac he's currently using, she'll find one piece of paper, a sheet of stationery actually, with "From the Desk of Scott Landon" printed across the top, upon which he has scrawled, "Tractor chain, say you're too late, Scoot, you old Scoot, even now." It's only when that cold wind, the one all the way down from Yellowknife, is booming around the house that she'll finally see the deep crescent moon cuts in the palms of his hands. Cuts he could only have made with his own fingernails as he struggled to hold on to his life and sanity, like a mountain climber trying to hold on to a smucking ledge in a sleet storm. It's only later that she'll find his cachet of empty Beam bottles, better than 12 in all. And on that one, at least, she's able to give herself a pass, because those empties were well hidden. 4. The first couple of days of 1996 are unseasonably warm. It is what the old-timers call the January thaw. But as early as January 3rd, the weather forecasters begin warning of a big change, an awesome cold wave rolling down from the white wastes of central Canada. Mainers are told to make sure their fuel oil tanks are topped up, that their water pipes are insulated, and that they have plenty of warm space for their animals. Temperatures are going to drop to 25 degrees below zero, but the temperatures are going to be the very least of it. They're going to be accompanied by gale-force winds that will drive the chill factor to 60 or 70 below. Lisi is frightened enough to call their general contractor after failing to raise any real concern in Scott. Gary assures her that the Landons have got the tightest house in Castle View, tells her he'll keep a close eye on Lisi's kinfolk, especially on Amanda, it almost goes without saying, and reminds her that cold weather is just a part of living in Maine. "A few three-dog nights and we'll be on the way to spring," he says. But when the sub-zero cold and screaming winds finally roll in on the 5th of January, It's worse than anything Lisey can remember, even casting her mind back to childhood, when every thunderbuster she rode out gleefully as a child seemed magnified into a great tempest, and every snow flurry was a blizzard. She keeps all the thermostats in the house turned up to 75, and the new furnace runs constantly, but between the 6th and the 9th, the temperature inside never rises above 62. The wind doesn't just hoot around the eaves, it screams like a woman being gutted an inch at a time by a madman, one with a dull knife. The snow left on the ground by the January thaw is lifted by those 40-mile-an-hour winds. The gusts kick up to 65, high enough to knock down half a dozen radio towers in central Maine and New Hampshire, and blown across the fields like dancing ghosts. When they hit the storm windows, the granular particles rattle like hail. On the second night of this extravagant Canadian cold, Lisey wakes up at 2 in the morning, and Scott is gone from their bed once more. She finds him in the guest room, again bundled up in Good Ma's yellow African, once more watching the last picture show. Hank Williams warbles Kalijah. Sam the Lion is dead. She has difficulty rousing him, but at last Lisey manages. She asks him if he's all right, and Scott says yeah, he is. He tells her to look out the window, tells her it's beautiful, but to be careful, not to look too long. "My daddy said it would burn your eyes when it's that bright," he advises. She gasps for the beauty of it. There are great drifting theater curtains in the sky, and they change color as she watches. Green goes to purple, purple to vermilion, vermilion to a queer bloody shade of red she cannot name. Russet perhaps comes close, but that isn't it exactly. She thinks no one has ever named the shade she's seeing. When Scott twitches the back of her nightgown and tells her that's enough, she ought to stop. She's stunned to look at the digital clock next to the VCR and discover that she's been looking out at the frost-framed window at the Northern Lights for 10 minutes. "Don't look anymore," he says in the nagging, dragging tones of one who speaks in his sleep. "Come back to bed with me, little Lisey." She's glad enough to go, glad enough to kill that somehow awful movie, to get him out of the rocker in the chilly back room. But as she leads him up the hall by the hand, he says something that makes her skin prickle. "The wind sounds like the tractor chain, and the tractor chain sounds like my daddy," he says. "What if he's not dead?" "Scott, that's bullshit," she replies. "But things like that don't sound like bullshit in the middle of the night, do they? Especially when the wind screams and the sky is so full of colors it seems to be screaming back." When she wakes up the following night, the wind is still howling, and this time when she goes down to the guest room, the TV isn't on, but he's in there watching it anyway. He's in the rocking chair and bundled up in the African, Good Ma's yellow African. But he won't answer her, won't even look at her. Scott is there, but Scott is also gone. He's gone, Gomer. 5. Lisey rolled over on her back in Scott's study and looked up at the skylight directly overhead. Her breast throbbed. Without thinking about it, she pressed the yellow knitted square against it. At first the pain was even worse, but then there was a small measure of comfort. She looked into the skylight, panting. She could smell the sour brew of sweat, tears, and blood in which her skin was marinating. She moaned. "All the Landons are fast healers. We had to be." If it was true, and she had reason to believe it was, then she had never so much wanted to be a Landon as she did now. No more Lisa DeBuscher from Lisbon Falls, Mama and Daddy's afterthought, little tag-along. "You are who you are," Scott's voice responded patiently. "You're Lisey Landon, my little Lisey." But it was hot, and she hurt so much. Now she was the one who wanted ice, and voice or no voice, Scott Landon had never seemed so smucking dead. "So weeza, baby love," he insisted, but that voice was far, far. Even the phone on Dumbo's Big Jumbo, from which she could theoretically summon help, seemed far. And what seemed close? A question. A simple one, actually. How could she have found her own sister like that and not have remembered finding her husband like that during the cold wave of 1996? "I did remember," her mind whispered to her, as she lay looking up at the skylight with the yellow knitted square turning red against her breast. I did. But to remember Scott in the rocker was to remember the antlers. To remember the antlers was to remember what happened when we went from under the yum-yum tree out into the snow. To remember that was to face the truth about his brother Paul. To face the true memory of Paul meant doubling back to that cold guest room with the northern lights filling the sky as the wind boomed down from Canada, from Manitoba, all the way from Yellowknife. Don't you see, Lisey? It was all connected. It always has been. And once you allowed yourself to make the first connection, to push over the first domino. I would have gone crazy, she whimpered. Like them. Like the Landons and the Landros and whoever else knows about this. No wonder they went nuts. To know there's a world right next door to this one. And the wall between is so thin. But not even that was the worst. The worst was the thing that had so haunted him. The mottled thing with the endless piebald side. No, she shrieked at the empty study. She shrieked even though it hurt her all the way down. Oh, no, stop, make it stop, make these things stop. But it was too late, and too true to deny any longer, no matter how great the risk of madness. There really was a place where food turned bad, sometimes outright poisonous after dark, and where that piebald thing, Scott's long boy, I'll make how it sounds when it looks around, might be real. Oh, it's real, all right, Lisey whispered. I saw it. In the empty, haunted air of the dead man's study, she began to weep. Even now she didn't know for sure if this was true, and exactly when she had seen it, if it was. But it felt true. The kind of hope-ending thing cancer patients glimpse in their bleary bedside water glasses when all the medicine is taken, and the morphine pump reads zero, and the hour is none, and the pain is still in there, eating its steady way deeper into your wakeful bones. And alive. Alive, malevolent, and hungry. The kind of thing she was sure her husband had tried and failed to drink away, and laugh away, and write away. The thing she had almost seen in his empty eyes as he sat in the chilly guest room with the TV this time blank and silent. He sat in... 6. He sits in the rocking chair, wrapped to his staring eyes in Good Ma's hellaciously cheery yellow African. He looks both at her and through her. He doesn't respond to her increasingly frantic repetitions of his name, and she doesn't know what to do. Call someone, she thinks, that's what, and hurries back down the hall to their bedroom. Canty and Rich are in Florida and will be until the middle of February, but Darla and Matt are just down the road, and it's Darla's number she intends to dial. She's far past worrying about waking them up in the middle of the night. She needs to talk to someone. She needs help. She doesn't get it. The bitter gale, the one that's making her cold even in her flannel nightgown with a sweater thrown on top for good measure, the one that's making the furnace in the cellar run constantly as the house creaks and groans and sometimes even cracks alarmingly. That big cold wind down from Canada has torn a line down somewhere on the view, and all she hears when she picks up the phone is an idiot, She diddles the phone's cutoff button a couple of times with the tip of her finger anyway, because that's what you do, but she knows it will do no good, and it doesn't. She's alone in this big old converted Victorian house on Sugar Top Hill, as the skies bloom with crazy Jane curtains of color, and the temperatures drop to regions of cold best left unimagined. If she tries going next door to the Galloways, she knows the chances are good she'll lose an earlobe or a finger, maybe a couple, to frostbite. She might actually freeze to death on their stoop before she can rouse them. This is the kind of cold you absolutely do not fool with. She returns the useless phone to its cradle and hurries back down the hall to him, her slippers whispering. He is as she left him, the whining 50s vintage country music soundtrack of the last picture show in the middle of the night was bad, but the silence is worse, worse, worst. And just before a giant gust of wind seizes the house and threatens to push it off its foundations, she can hardly believe they haven't lost the electric. Surely they will before much longer. She realizes why even the big wind is a relief. She can't hear him breathing. He doesn't look dead. There's even some color in his cheeks, But how does she know he's not? Honey, she murmurs, going to him. Hun, can you talk to me? Can you look at me?
He says nothing, and he doesn't look at her, but when she puts her chilly fingers against his neck, she finds that the skin there is warm, and she feels the beat of his heart in the big vein or artery that lies just beneath the skin. And something else. She can feel him reaching out to her. In daylight, even cold daylight, windy daylight, like the kind that seems to pervade all the exteriors in the last picture show now that she thinks of it, she's sure she would scoff at that, but not now. Now she knows what she knows. He needs help, just as much as he did on that day in Nashville, first when the madman shot him, and then as he lay shivering on the hot pavement, begging for ice.
How do I help you? She murmurs. How do I help you now?
It's Darla who answers, Darla as she was as a teenager, full of young tits and mean, good Ma had once said, an uncharacteristic vulgarity for her, so she must have been exasperated out of all measure.
You aren't going to help him? Why are you talking about helping him? Darla asks, and that voice is so real Lisey can almost smell the coaty face powder Darla was allowed to use, because of her blemishes, and hear the pop of her double bubble.
And say, she's been down to the pool and cast her net, and brought back quite a catch.
He's off his rocker, Lisey, popped his cork, lost his marbles. He's riding the rubber tricycle, and the only way you can help him is to call for the men in the white coats as soon as the phone's working again.
Lisey hears Darla's laugh, that laugh of perfect teenage contempt, deep in the center of her head as she looks down at her wide-eyed husband sitting in the rocker.
Help him? Darla snorts. Help him? Jesus pleases.
And yet Lisey thinks she can. Lisey thinks there's a way. The trouble is that the way to help is possibly dangerous and not at all sure. She's honest enough to recognize that she has made some of the problems herself. She has stowed away certain memories, such as their amazing exit from beneath the yum-yum tree, and hidden unbearable truths, the truth about Paul the saintly brother, for instance, behind a sort of curtain in her mind. There's a certain sound, the chuffing, dear God, that low, nasty grunting, behind there, and certain sights, the crosses, the graveyard, the crosses in the bloodlight, as well. She wonders sometimes if everyone has a curtain like that in their minds, one with a don't-think zone behind it. They should. It's handy. Saves a lot of sleepless nights. There's all sorts of dusty old crapola behind hers. Stuff like a this, stuff like a that, stuff like a the other thing. All in all, it's quite a maze. Oh, little Lizzy, how you amazin' ze me, mein Gott.
And what do the kids say?
Don't go in ze there, Lizzy mutters, but she thinks she will. She thinks if she is to have any chance of saving Scott, of bringing him back, she must go in ze there, wherever there is. Oh, but it's right next door. That's the horror of it.
You know, don't you? She says, beginning to weep.
But it isn't Scott she's asking. Scott has gone to where the Gomers go. Once upon a time, under the yum-yum tree where they sat protected from the world by the strange October snow, he had referred to his job of writing stories as a kind of madness. She had protested, she, practical Lisey, to whom everything was the same, and he had said, "You don't understand the gone part. I hope you stay lucky that way, little Lisey." But tonight, while the wind booms down from Yellowknife and the sky blooms with wild colors, her luck has run out. 7. Lying on her back in her dead husband's study, holding the bloody delight against her breast, Lisey said, "I sat down beside him and worked his hand out from under the African so I could hold it." She swallowed. There was a click in her throat. She wanted more water but didn't trust herself to get up, not just yet. His hand was warm, but the floor... 8. The floor is cold, even through the flannel of her nightgown and the flannel of her long johns and the silk panties beneath the longies. This room, like all of them upstairs, has baseboard heat that she can feel if she stretches out the hand that isn't holding Scott's, but it's small comfort. The endlessly laboring furnace sends it up, the baseboard heaters send it out, it creeps about 6 inches along the floorboards, and then poof, gone.
like the stripes on the barber's pole, like cigarette smoke when it rises, like husbands sometimes. Never mind the cold floor. Never mind if your ass turns blue. If you can do something for him, do it. But what is that something? How is she supposed to start? The answer seems to come on the next gust of wind. Start with the tea cure. He never told me about that because I never asked. This comes out of her so rapidly it could almost be one long, exotic word. If so, it's an exotic one-word lie. He answered her question about the tea cure that night at the Antlers, in bed, after love. She asked him two or three questions, but the one that mattered, the key question, turned out to be that first one. Simple, too. He could have answered with a plain old yes or no, but when had Scott Landon ever answered anything with a plain old yes or no? And it turned out to be the cork in the neck of the bottle. Why? Because it returned them to Paul. And the story of Paul was, essentially, the story of his death. And the death of Paul led to... No, please, she whispers, and realizes she's squeezing his hand far too tight. Scott, of course, makes no protest. In the parlance of the Landon family, he has gone Gomer. Sounded funny when you put it that way, almost like a joke on hee-haw.
Say, Buck, where's Roy? Well, I'll tell you, Minnie. Roy's gone Gomer.
Audience howls with laughter. But Lisey isn't laughing, and she doesn't need any of her interior voices to tell her Scott has gone to Gomerland. If she wants to fetch him back, first she must follow him.
Oh, God, no,
she moans, because what that means is already looming in the back of her mind, a large shape wrapped in many sheets.
Oh, God, do I have to?
God doesn't answer, nor does she need him to. She knows what she needs to do, or at least how she needs to start. She must remember their second night at the Antlers, after love. They had been drowsing toward sleep, and she had thought, what's the harm? It's saintly big brother you want to know about, not old devil daddy. Go ahead and ask him. So she did. Sitting on the floor with his hand, it's cooling now, folded into hers, and the wind booming outside, and the sky filled with crazy color, she peers around the curtain she's put up to hide her worst, most perplexing memories, and sees herself asking him about the tea cure. Asking him. 9. After that thing on the bench, did Paul soak his cuts in tea the way you soaked your hand that night in my apartment? He's lying in bed next to her, the sheet pulled up to his hips so she can see the beginning curl of his pubic hair. He's smoking what he calls the always fabulous post-coital cigarette, and the only light in the room is cast down on them by the lamp on his side of the bed. In the rose dusty glow of that lamp, the smoke rises and disappears into the dark, making her wonder briefly, was there a sound, a clap of collapsing air under the yum-yum tree when we went, when we left, about something she's already working to put out of her mind? Meanwhile, the silence is stretching out. She has just about decided he won't answer when he does. And his tone makes her believe it was careful thought and not reluctance that made him pause. I'm pretty sure the tea cure came later, Lisey. He thinks a little more, nods. Yeah, I know it did, because by then I was doing fractions. 1/3 + 1/4 = 7/12, stuff like that. He grins, but Lisey, who is coming to know his repertoire of expressions well, thinks it is a nervous grin. In school, she asks. No, Lisey. His tone says she should know better than this, and when he speaks again, she can hear that somehow chilling childishness,
I tried,
creeping into his voice.
Me and Paul, we is homeschooled. Daddy called public school the donkey corral.
On the night table beside the lamp is an ashtray sitting on top of his copy of Slaughterhouse-5. Scott takes a book with him everywhere he goes, there are absolutely no exceptions. And he flicks his cigarette into it. Outside, the wind gusts and the old inn creaks. It suddenly seems to Lisey that perhaps this isn't such a good idea after all, that the good idea would be to just roll over and go to sleep. But she is two-hearted, and her curiosity drives her on. And Paul's cuts that day, the day you jumped from the bench, were bad? Not just nicks? I mean, you know the way kids see things. Any busted pipe looks like a flood. She trails off. There's a very long pause while he watches the smoke from his cigarette rise out of the lamp's beam and disappear. When he speaks again, his voice is dry and flat